This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
Herbie in Harrow. Good morning.
Yep. Good morning, Nick. Good morning, Nigel.
Hello.
Nigel, do you think that the documentaries that have been put out on both Channel 4 and Channel 5 of late have done any favours to our party, considering that the people they portrayed aren't the true supporters of UKIP? I think they've done a lot of damaging reports, and I think it's a bit anti-UKIP, to be honest.
Well, there appears to be a docudrama every single week on a different channel, some of whom have painted me out to be one of the greatest monsters that's been seen in global politics for the last 100 years. I mean, all I can say, Herbie, is the last one. Where they found all sorts of people who claimed to be UKIP supporters, and they were looking for, you know, the most eccentric, outrageous people they could find. You could do that with any political party. You could go out there and find Labour and Tory supporters that were absolutely crackers. All I can say is this: I take all of this as an absolutely tremendous compliment. We are rocking the establishment back on their heels. They're scared. They're fighting back. Do you know what we're going to do, Herbie? We're going to ignore them. And carry on doing what we're doing.
Quick response, Herbie.
Well, that's good news. No. Well, that's good news, Nigel, because I think, you know, some of them that came on there just does not portray the hard-working people that are supporting UKIP and going out down there door-knocking and putting our policies forward and, you know, and discussing about what the nation now needs. We're talking to people and we're getting the response that we want.
Yeah, well, Herbie, thank you. And you're right. You know, UKIP people are ordinary, decent people from across the spectrum. In fact, we're one of the most open, eclectic parties in British politics, and they try and paint us out
you're
as mad.
You're not going to thank me for this, but Jill, a former nurse from Poole in Dorset, featured on one of these TV shows, yeah. Nigel Farage, called Farage Fans and UKIP Lovers. It aired earlier this week.
Nigel Farage has been sent by God. He probably doesn't realise it. Like God says, when an enemy comes against you, like a massive flood, I'll send someone to give you some protection or send something to protect you. And I think Nigel Farage is sent to protect us against the EU.
Have you been sent by God?
Jill, I'm sure, is an absolutely delightful woman, but I have to disappoint her. Jill, I am not the Messiah. I'm a very naughty boy.
Nice line. We move on, Mr. Farage.
Sharon in Slough, good morning.
Good morning, Nigel.
Hi.
Nigel, I've already met you once. I gate-crashed a photo shoot in Amersham.
Right, good.
I don't know whether you remember me. It was a bit taken back, but you signed a piece of paper for me. Anyway, I'm asking for all of the families that have been duped by the care system in this country, and their families and children have been abused in the care system. What will UKIP do for the families to give us a voice? Because we are not allowed to blow the whistle. And yesterday, speaking to the Labour Party whips in the whips office, apparently the government do not rule the councils. So these people fail the children.
Right.
They then move to different parts of the country, and they get away scot-free.
Well, let's see what the response is.
Sharon, I am not an expert on the care system or childcare. Not an expert, but everything I've seen and everything I've learnt, particularly from places like Rotherham, and I see the growth of secret family courts, and I see the most extraordinary power that the state has to remove children from parents and very often put them into situations that are perhaps worse than where they came from. When I see that a loving couple who wanted to adopt a child the other week were told they couldn't because the chap had smoked an e-cigarette. You know, I wonder, I genuinely, Sharon, wonder what has happened to the whole of our childcare services and provision in this country. My own view is most certainly we have to end these secret family courts. I think it's just too much power, frankly, in the hands of the judiciary and the state. And every week that goes by now, we hear about... I mean, it was Oxford this week, wasn't it? We hear about sexual abuse.
350 girls over 15 years.
You know, and Rotherham was 1,400, and we remember Rochdale. This story seems to get worse and worse and worse. All I can say is that in Parliament, one of the things that I will campaign for if I'm successful and I get there is for us to have a proper, open, public review of childcare services in Britain with the view to having a completely wholesale reform of something that clearly is failing a lot of children.
Who would you have chair that? How would you institute
well,
that?
Well, you're right, because we just had a massive row, you know, to try and choose somebody to get involved with the inquiry over potentially awful problems in Westminster. I haven't got the answer to that.
No.
And I don't pretend I have the answer to everything.
And when the inquiry, as you probably saw into the events in Oxfordshire, says that the high proportion of Pakistani males involved in the grooming, this, as they said, quotes, needs to be addressed, close quotes, how is that addressed, in your view, Mr. Farage?
By ending political correctness and cowardice. You know, what we've seen in one or two of these instances are childcare services and politicians at local level, and one even admitted at national level, that they decided it was better not to listen and to turn their heads away rather than to engage themselves in a process that might lead them to be thought to be racist. And that has to go away. We've got to stop this. We've got to start treating everybody in Britain equally, regardless of their colour, age, class, race. We're all one, and that's how we've got to operate.
Where do we go, Mr. Farage?
OK, we're going to Birmingham to speak to Ranjit. Good morning.
Hello, Nigel. Increasing numbers of working-class Britons seem to have got the message that our membership of the EU and the resultant free movement of people means a lower chance of work, lower wages, lower chance of getting on the housing ladder, lower you know chances of getting in hospital, everything. But the same message hasn't got through to non-white Britain, working-class Britons. Why do you think that is? What do you think you can do to make them come over to you, like increasing the working class Britons in general.
No,
they're even more represented amongst the working classes and are even suffering even worse.
You are quite right, and you raise a very good point. The one sector of young working class people who have been affected by this more than anybody else are the young black population, particularly in London, who has found themselves displaced, and we've actually seen youth unemployment rates amongst London's black community in some pockets as high as 50%. There is a massive problem there. And you're right, Ranjit, they are part of the left behinds as well. And I want to re-emphasise what I said to the last caller, that it is important that we view us all as being one, regardless of what colour we are. And if I can make that black community, and they are beginning to come to UKIP. They are beginning to attend our meetings and listen. If I can make them understand...
What would you say to them? They're listening
all the
now.
All the demonisation. You know, I mean, Herbie earlier talked about the programmes, you know, as if I was going to deport everybody, you know, that hadn't been here since 1850. I mean, quite extraordinary level of demonisation that's going on, and we are an open, tolerant, inclusive party. Our conference in Margate last week was the most eclectic mix of people you could ever see. And I think once we get through that prejudice that people have about us, that many parts of the media want them to have, then I think they will be voting for us and joining this call. You know, and Ranjit actually put his finger on it, that actually the life chances of working people have been done down by mass open-door immigration.
Can I just take you away from politics for one second, Nigel Farage? I'm sort of heard in the news that Harrison Ford mercifully has survived.
I know, I saw that.
Yeah, and it seems he's actually did an extraordinary act in bringing the plane down almost in one piece.
Yeah.
A few years ago, that was you. What goes through your mind when you realise the plane's hurtling to the ground?
Whenever I see a plane crash on the television, it sort of fills me with a little shiver down the spine. What goes through your mind? In my case, to begin with, fear and thoughts whirring through your head at a speed that you can't imagine. And then towards the end of it, as the ground rushes up, a sense of resignation and a crossing of the fingers and a thought, if this is it, let's hope it's over quickly.
He survived. He's in a serious condition, but he hopefully will make a recovery. We've got time, I think, for one more.
We do, and we are going to Mitchell in Norwood.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm a first-time voter, and I'll be going off to university this year. I was just wondering, you said that in your 2010 manifesto, it was drivel. Well, you said it was drivel, the manifesto. So how can anyone be sure that you won't be saying the same things in 5 years' time about your current policies?
Well, no. we had a massive PR problem with our 2010 manifesto. A 12-page document that was put to me and signed off was fine. Behind it were 486 pages of detailed notes that went on the UKIP website and were then deemed to be the manifesto. And much of that were sort of intellectual wanderings, is the best way that I can put it. That's why I called it
dribble. You signed off on it, though, Mr. Barrett.
I signed off on a 12-page document. I did. You're absolutely right. I wasn't leader of the party. I was leader of the MEP group. I was presented with a 12-page document that I was very happy with, and I would sit here and defend every one of those policies here today. What I did not know were that people playing academic games behind the scenes had loaded up the website with the longest manifesto. It's almost as long as War and Peace. So, you know, we made some... And Mitchell, can I just say this to you? That when you're a new political party emerging and growing up, you do make some mistakes, and that was a mistake.
Quick response, Mitchell.
Thank you.
All right, that's it. Just before good. I let you go, and we finish Phone Farage, I don't know if you were listening yesterday to call Clegg on LBC, where the Deputy Prime Minister sat in the very same seat,
yep,
and took a call from one of your prospective UKIP councillors, Keith in Finchley.
I will bet you, I don't know, what shall I bet you? I'll bet you several pints that we will have, the Liberal Democrats will have many, 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 many more MPs than your party after May the 7th. And so I can not only bet, I can close to guarantee you that your party is going to be a little pipsqueak party after May the 7th.
Are you going to take
compared to the Liberal Democrats? And all your bluster and all your anger and all your kind of your brave talk, I think will dissolve like the morning mist.
How many points?
Three. I'm not going to spend
three.
I'm not going to spend six.
I'll give you the money. I'll cover the money.
All right, 6 points then. There
six
you go.
I'm point bet.
Well, a pipsqueak carsy, Mr. Clegg. How many MEPs have you got, Mr. Clegg? One. We got 24. Look, I think it's encouraging.
Are you going to join my round?
I think it's encouraging that Nick Clegg is clearly learning and has decided that pub politics is the future. Look, you know, his party have the advantage of incumbency. They've got seats where they've got members of Parliament. I don't know how many seats the Lib Dems are going to win. I don't know how many seats UKIP are going to win. None of us have got a clue. This is the most open general election we've seen for 100 years. But believe me, all the bluster, all the negativity we're hearing at the moment, it's irrelevant. It won't be until after Easter that the great British public start looking at this and thinking about it. And I think all bets are off.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on Breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on Breakfast here on LBC.
I'm going to show you something about the cable car, which I think our listeners now know because they'll have heard me say it so many times.
5, 10 or 20.
It is the only piece of transport infrastructure in London that is going to cover both its capital and its revenue costs in the next 10 years or so.
That is
an incredible achievement. Which I don't care whether it's 5
it's
or 20. 10 or
it's
20.
It's the highest number of closures ever
and
of this period of year since it was since it was constructed.
Big deal. You know,
I can't really answer that, can I? When you said in January,
come on,
you've got to have a very...
You know, by the way, ridership, by the way, I don't know why you're giving battle on this field, which is so completely unfavourable to your course, because actually the cable car is showing stunning increases in ridership. And
the trouble is, people might want to go down.
It's
they have to
wonderful.
Check it's not a windy day.
Well, you know, you've got to be careful. You can't have... over most of the time, the cable car is functioning beautifully and brilliantly, and I urge people
to
get on it. And people love it. When they get on it, they absolutely love it. You see London in a way you've never seen it before.
It's
absolutely true. And it's getting more and more ridership and in the end, it's going to pay for itself. If you add up the sponsorship plus the, it's already covering it. Do you know, the cable car already covers its revenue costs. So with the fees we're getting from the users, you can't say that of the tube, my friend.
Right.
You can't say that of the buses, amigo. You know, that is the cable car.
Okay. When you said in January, you've got to have very tough security solutions. You've got to be absolutely determined to monitor these people, potential terrorists. You've got to know where they are and who they are talking to. How much eavesdropping are you prepared to?
Well, you know, there has to be a balance struck, and you know, I've obviously what I'm saying is intended to give support to our police, to the security services in what they tell me they need, and I don't want absolutely some universal right for junior police officers to surf everybody's email accounts or what, you know, that, obviously that's wrong.
But you do have control
to be,
orders,
there
right?
have to be proper protections, and there has to be judicial oversight. I think that's the key thing, and that's certainly the point I would make in respect of journalistic phone records, for instance. But there's got to be the fundamental ability of the security services and the police to be able to access this stuff pretty promptly if they need to. We're talking about people who can use social media, who can use the internet to communicate. If they are doing so in such a way as to prepare to commit atrocities, I think most people would want our police, our security services, to have that basic ability. And, you know, I don't have a principled objection to that. I really, really don't. On control orders, as I've said, the argument that's been put to me is that we need to get away from TPIMS, which stands for...
I remember, do you?
Give me the thing again.
Well, you've just mentioned it, I didn't.
Terrorism prevention something measure.
You've mentioned it, not me.
We need to get...
What, is it, what do they stand for again?
You know. If you were, we need to get
you're
away
well-educated,
from
that. I only told you 20 minutes
we need
ago.
To get away from the TPIM, whatever it stands for, and get back to the...
Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measure.
Thank you. The Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measure.
You brought it up, not me. And, don't well, glare at me.
I'm not glaring at you. No, I'm not glaring at you. I'm delighted that you've re-elucidated our listeners on this point. But, you know, the Terrorism Prevention and Investigation Measure, we need to get away from.
Right.
And what we need to do is
go
back to control orders. And can we go to Len in Oxford?
Len, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Yeah, good morning, Bobby Boris. Next stop is not horrible to Boris, will you?
He's not bad. Actually, he's just very hungover.
We move on. I am not hungover. I drank water. Because Kelvin McKenzie can testify. Right, on we go, Len.
Anyway, two very simple questions, Boris. Hypothetically, if there was no leader of the party at the moment, I'm a strong UKIP supporter for my friends. If you ran for Prime Minister, I would vote Conservatives. And the second question is, are you capable of being Prime Minister? There you go.
Well, what I'm capable of is campaigning hard for my friend David Cameron to get re-elected. And I think, by the way, that he will, Len. And if you look at the polls, they are moving very, very well. You know, that you had two yesterday, which are giving us a 3-point lead. I'm encouraged by that.
Hypothetically, Boris.
I think that the... You know, the straws in the wind are now starting to turn into a bit of a... Can you have a bale of straws in the wind? I mean, I don't know whether you could have a bale.
Who are you drinking with, love? Oh, you were at the St. David's Day dinner.
There's a bale of straws in the wind, in my view, Len, that are inclining me to think that we're going to be... people are basically making a calculation. The economy is turning round. Things are getting better. Jobs are being created to get at a scale we haven't seen, a rate we haven't seen for a long time, and I don't think they're going to want Labour to screw it up.
You didn't quite answer. Let's put the question again.
Len's hypothetical questions, I'm afraid, potentially flattering they may be to anybody, are just not going to materialise them.
All right. Why do you vote UKIP, lastly, Len, if I might ask you that? If I may ask you?
Based on the character of Farage, maybe he's a bit wishy-washy here and there, but he's got kind of the right ideas. In my opinion, he's the best of the bad lot at the moment. I would prefer to vote someone like Conservative, and my only way I would change my vote is if Boris ran for Prime Minister. I'm sorry, Cameron's, in my opinion, is just not cut out for it now.
Len, you know, as politicians, as you know, always say, you know, I hear what you say, but in the end, David Cameron is, I think, doing a fantastic job. You know, he's got he's cut out to be a Prime Minister. He's plainly, you know, made from Prime Ministerial timber. Unlike, I think, Ed Miliband. And ultimately, Len, you may think you want Nigel Farage and all the rest of it, but in the end, you vote for him, you're going to get Ed Miliband, and that, I think, would be an absolute shocker for our country.
We move on, Len. Thank you for your call. Where are we going next, Mr. Mayor?
Can we go to Jonathan in Hertfordshire?
Oh, good morning, Mr. Mayor.
Good morning, sir.
Just a quick question. Obviously, with the BBC charter coming up for negotiations next year, do you think the BBC should lose their licence? Should it be abolished?
I have to say, I can't see how it can go on forever, having a tax on TVs that, you know, not everybody uses anymore. I can't. I can barely make my TV work. Frankly, sometimes I come down. I sit at home, waiting for. I'm shouting pathetically for some child to come and help me turn it on. I have no idea.
Well, hopefully, one of your children. Otherwise, we really have got a problem.
Shut up. I have no idea. Uncalled for, pointless, low blow. I have no idea sometimes how to turn it on. The TV is not now the
it's
way
not the
that
BBC's
many
fault,
many
Mr.
people
Mayor. You don't know how to switch on your TV.
There's a broader point, which is many people now no longer get their news. Many young people, in particular, no longer get their news from TV. From they don't
it's
listen.
All on these.
They don't listen to the Today programme. They don't listen to I don't watch TV news anymore. I'm ashamed to say I really don't. You get it all from it's all on the web. So the BBC needs to think about its future. I happen to think that there is a case for having a very high standard of public broadcasting. Now, whether you need the full whack of the licence fee, all that money, I must say I somehow doubt. And I think that, you know, there is going to have to be a change. I think that the we are moving in that direction. I was struck the other day that the Parliamentary Committee said the licence fee should be prolonged for another 10 years. That seems to me to be too long, not to be taking account of the very rapid changes
in every house would pay a levy. In a way, isn't it even more? Well, Lord Hall, the Director General, was suggesting, and he clearly buys much of your argument.
Tony Hall does buy the. I mean, Well, at the moment, every house pays £150 in a levy on their television, which is crap.
Yeah, but now they'll pay even if they haven't got a telly.
Well, the question is, how much will they pay, and what will they be supporting? And
so you pay a levy for something you haven't got.
Well, yeah, what you're talking about is some form of taxation anyway. You're talking about some form of taxation for the BBC. The basic question that Jonathan is asking is, do you need public sector broadcasting at all? Should we be putting taxpayers' money into broadcasting? And I think the argument would be that we put taxpayers' money into supporting all sorts of arts. We support, you know, and they would die in this country if we didn't have support for the arts. I think you probably do need to support quality broadcasting, proper, fantastic production such as the BBC specialises. Whether you need to support the whole machine the BBC, by the way, can be extremely anti-competitive. They take huge sums of money from the taxpayer, from the licence payer, and use it to cross-subsidise businesses that demolish local newspapers, local websites, all sorts of ways in which the BBC is deeply anti-competitive. So I think my answer to Jonathan would be this thing needs to be rethought. The licence fee is plainly anachronistic. I think Tony Hall's on the right line. It needs to be trimmed. It needs to be cut. I think you're never going to get away from a situation in which people feel the certainty that we are supporting really, really high quality public broadcasting in this country. I think it'd be a shame to lose that.
All right.
I'm going to go to Nicky in St John's Wood.
Hi, Nick.
Hello, that's Nicky Clark.
Nicky Clark,
isn't it? Yes, indeed. You're through to someone who could certainly do with your skills.
Clark.
Yes, the hairdresser.
Oh, yes, right, yes, Nicky, absolutely.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
Massive London business this
absolutely.
Man runs.
Well, congratulations, Mr. Clark. How's it going?
It's going very, very well. Actually, I'm going to just put out there, Nick, do you remember we had a conversation, must have been about 4 or 5 years ago?
Yep.
Pre the cable car crossing, and I said to you, you know, Nick, I've just come back from skiing and I've had this wonderful idea about having a cable car or sets of cable cars that actually run along the embankment.
Yes.
And I remember you saying to me, well, we should tell Boris.
Yes.
What a great idea.
Yes.
But of course, actually, what we have now is actually going across.
Yes.
Why have we not thought about actually running either north to south or certainly down the embankment with, you know, the system that we see on the Alps all the time?
Nicky, it's a very, very interesting idea. I think we'd have to study the business case.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
So let's go straight to our first caller, and it's Peter in West Hampstead. Good morning.
Hello, Nigel. This business about the leaders' debates on the TV, I think there's absolutely no question that Cameron needs this and will benefit from it potentially. I think there's a reason, and I'm particularly interested to know what you think the reason is. There's a specific lump of a reason, and I'm wondering if you can say what you reckon his reason is.
Peter, let me tell you that the day that Ofcom came out with a ruling that UKIP was now a major party in British politics, along with the Conservatives, the Lib Dems and the Labour Party, was the day that David Cameron said we couldn't have the debates without the Greens. After that, there followed a series of private meetings where the parties all sent their press officers to meet the broadcasters. It was clear to us from the very first meeting that the intention of David Cameron's team was to destroy the debates and to try and stop them from happening at all. Why? Well, firstly, back in 2010, he did come out the worst from the debates, and they feared that happening again. Secondly, I think, and perhaps I'm right, perhaps I'm wrong, and maybe we'll get some calls on this, but I actually think that David Cameron is pretty scared of confronting face-to-face some of the arguments that UKIP would have made. So we then finished up with Uncle Tom Cobley and all being invited. The broadcasters proposed three dates in April, and just remember, the general election proper doesn't start until April. And Cameron now has said he won't do any debates in the election proper, but will do one this month. I don't think these debates are going to happen. I just hope one thing, Peter. I hope the broadcasters actually have the guts to come back and say we are going ahead as planned with our three debates. And Mr. Cameron, it's up to you whether you turn up or not.
What's known in the trade, Mr. Farage, is an empty chair.
Well, yes, I mean, it would be an empty chair if he chose not to come. I personally think, Nick, had they called his bluff from day one, he would have turned up. And I don't understand why the broadcasters have been so weak about this. I mean, who knows? Perhaps LBC can do something. I mean, you know, why
My
not?
My offices are open on that. Peter, let's see how you react to Mr. Farage.
I think I agree with him, but I think there's something else. I have a feeling that the historical paedophile business is going to completely blow sky high, and he doesn't want an hour and a half of uncontrolled Lord knows what. But I think I do agree with you, Nigel. I also think that the regional representatives should have a regional TV programme. It is absolutely ridiculous when everybody will get about 60 seconds per response.
Oh, yeah. I mean, look, Peter...
Should the SNP be on the same stage with you and Plaid Cymru?
Well, let's just look at it. So, if we have a national, UK-wide TV debate with Plaid, 95% of listeners will not be able to vote for Plaid. It is nonsense. So I think Peter's right. There should be, yes, Scottish debates, Welsh debates, Northern Irish debates, and then a UK-wide debate. So I think Mr. Cameron has been very successful in torpedoing something that the British public very much wanted to have, which is leaders' debates. Anyway, we'll see where we go. And
lastly, you say that you don't think Mr. Cameron will be able to face some of the UKIP arguments in your debate. What particularly do you think would you be able to hit him with, Nigel Farage?
Two arguments. Very quickly. One, he says they've been marvellously successful with their long-term management plan for the economy. Would you confirm, Mr. Cameron, that the national debt has doubled in your 5 years of premiership? Quite tough to answer that, really, isn't it? And, of course, Labour won't attack him on it because their record was so awful as well. And secondly, you know, I've been reading Tory literature that's going through doors up and down the country where you talk about controlling immigration. How can you control immigration if you have an open door in Europe to nearly 500 million people? And that's the one he doesn't want to confront. That's the one none of them want to confront, and they'd rather wasn't discussed. Anyway, moving on to Tony in Palmer's Green. Good morning.
Good morning, all. Nigel, I'd just like you to explain your immigration cap policy, please. If I give you a little background, is it a 50,000 cap or not? And you did say that the Commonwealth immigrants would be treated differently from those coming from the EU. I want to ask you if you think this might be dangerous, given that several Commonwealth countries have enormous populations in the hundreds of millions, and their earning is lower than even Romania.
Right,
Tony, hang on the line. You will come back to it.
Firstly, we have for years talked about upper limits or caps, but everybody's talked about caps, and frankly, the concept of caps, I think, has been somewhat devalued. And everyone talks about caps rather than talking about policy. So what we tried to do this week was to talk about policy, although the media are obsessing with caps, which is a bit frustrating. What we said, actually, earlier this week, was the toughest thing we've yet said on immigration, but it's been completely missed. We've said we want a moratorium on unskilled migrant labour for 5 years. That's a really very big statement we made that hasn't been touched on. Why? Because there is a massive oversupply of unskilled labour in this country. It is driving down the wages of people. It is pushing up the populations of many areas. It is putting massive pressure on schools, hospitals and all other public services. But what we did say, Tony, and this is where the Commonwealth bit comes into it, all right? What we did say is that at the moment we have a ridiculous situation where we now actually actively discriminate against people from the Commonwealth in favour of people from Southern and Eastern Europe. What we want to do, let me be absolutely clear, we want an Australian-style point system so that we can choose both the quantity and the quality of who comes to Britain, and we would judge people not on the country they come from. We would judge people on whether they were the right people who would come to Britain and make a positive contribution to society. And I would see the number every year coming in under that system. Rather than talking about a cap, I'll talk about a range of being between 20 and 50,000 people a year.
Ah, oh, so we are back to a number now. No, you were criticised a lot this week.
No, a range. You know, okay. Arbitrary cap, no, but I'm giving you a ballpark figure because it's going to be flexible.
Well, so currently it's 297,000, Mr Farage.
Yes.
You're confident you could look at that down to between 20, a range between 20 and 50?
Yes, because what we'd be doing...
That's drastic.
It is very drastic. And what's interesting, as I said earlier, we said some very tough things this week. That none of that's been commented on, as the media have had a field day around caps. And you know, caps, targets, floors, ceilings, I don't think anyone believes them anymore. So I've tried to talk about policy this week, and sadly, not perhaps always been allowed to.
And one of the people who criticised you was on this radio station, indeed, yep. In that seat, Lib Dem leader, Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg. He had this reaction to what he'd heard as of yesterday.
Look, I think Nigel Farage and indeed other parties have had a very nice time of it over the last couple of years. They can kind of almost make up stuff as they go along, and no one really scrutinises them like the media and others quite rightly scrutinise what I say and what other more established parties say. I think it's a good thing if this kind of one man band outfit, this slightly ramshackle outfit, UKIP, is actually subject to proper scrutiny, because for a long time they basically could say A in the morning, B in the evening, C in the, you know, at midnight, and just keep chopping and changing, and no one really took much notice. If they're now actually being put under some more exacting scrutiny, that's a good thing ahead of the election on May the 7th.
Well, you run this one-man ramshackle.
Well, yes. Look, I'm trying in this general election campaign not to return insults of any kind and to try and turn the other cheek, which, after years of tearing chunks out of people in the European Parliament, is a tough discipline. All I would say to Nick is that when it comes to inconsistency on policy, the Liberal Democrats are absolutely at the top of the tree, as they flipped and flopped and chopped and changed on everything over the last few years. And Nick says, I've had a nice time of it, talking about immigration. I tell you, Nick, who's not had a nice time of it? Ordinary, working, decent British families who have seen their wages compressed over the course of the last few years, their waiting times at accident and emergency go up, and in some parts of the country now, virtually no primary school places for their kids.
Just lastly, before we move on to other calls, it's interesting you say that about you won't trade insults. You were on television yesterday and you said of the attacks on Ed Miliband, particularly the personal attacks, it's vile, forget the politics of it, it's personal, yeah. It's nasty. You want a clean, good, clean fight in this election.
I think, look, you know, we all know that in politics there is a little bit of fun and mickey taking, and generally, when that's done with a good sense of humour, actually, it's fine. Everyone can live with it. It's fine. What you've seen with this election is you've seen Ed Miliband take on David Axelrod, a big Washington spin doctor, and David Cameron has taken on a guy called Jim Messina, again, a big Washington spin doctor. And in America, and I don't, you know, whether listeners have ever heard or seen any of this, in America, the election campaigns are dominated by radio and television adverts, which mercifully aren't allowed here, which tell you that the opposition candidate is a drunk and a womaniser and a ne'er-do-well, and it's all negative campaigning. And what I'm seeing in this election is the influence of these big American advisers, and it's becoming, I think, the most negative, nasty and personal campaign I've ever seen. Look, I don't
want to rise above that.
I don't agree with a lot of what Ed Miliband stands for, but he's a perfectly decent human being, and I think for him to be just attacked personally day after day after day, how is that taking us forward in terms of having a national debate? And I'm going to do my best over the next 60-odd days to rise above it. All right.
Where do we go now, Mr. Burrow?
We now go to Nick in Sheen. Good morning.
Yeah, morning, Nick. Nigel, how are you doing?
Good morning. Good, thanks.
Yeah. Quick question for you. I'm not going to mention immigration or EU or anything.
OK. That's fine.
Yesterday,
I'm relaxed, you know.
Yeah, that's good. By the Tories about child benefit and capping that to 3 kids.
Yeah.
I would like to know what UKIP's policy is on the family, on family welfare, family benefits. Bear in mind that your manifesto says that you would cap child benefits to 2 kids.
Mm-hmm.
Over to you, sir.
Yeah, no, we have in the past said that we would cap child benefits to 2 kids, and I expect that when our manifesto comes out, that that will be the same. However, what we will do, in terms of the family, is talk about transferable tax allowances. And if the limits of those are upped, then what you will find, actually, is that mothers or fathers that stay at home for the first few years to help the children will be able to benefit by the transfer of some of those unused tax allowances. And that is perhaps the biggest thing that we will do and say for the family. I'm hedging a little bit, Nick, because, you know, we've still got 60 days to go until this election, and I don't intend to release our manifesto until well after Easter, because I do actually think, apart from this campaign being very negative, I also think the public are getting quite bored with some of it.
This is Nick Ferrari with more to come as I look back at my week on breakfast. This is LBC. This is Nick Ferrari with a look back at my week on breakfast here on LBC.
We're of course, you were in bed with a good book or someone who's read one by 10 p.m. I'm sure.
Exactly right. It was St. David's Day dinner last night.
Where were you?
That
was
at the Guildhall with 430 people from the valleys.
Oh, there we go.
That was very good. Anyway, we're going first of all to Vincent in Earl's Court. Vincent.
Hi, Boris, you go on about your London transport system and that, and how it's the top one in the world and all that.
Yeah.
Basically, I was involved in a road traffic accident there just over 4 months ago in the city where a cyclist died under the back wheels of my truck.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Died because she couldn't afford your London transport. She was here on a voluntary course for 3 months. She was here 2 weeks, couldn't afford the transport system, and had to buy a push bike to and from the voluntary job. Now, you've been out in trucks and all that. It's all been staged and all that. Basically, it's all sterile. You don't go out and do the day's work that we actually do as lorry drivers. We come up against cyclists. They come down our near side and that all the time. We beep a horn. We get the finger. We get abused. What's the problem? You know, we've done what London Transport have asked us to do. We've done what the government have asked us to do. We've done our CPC. We've trained up to the last. We're in this industry years. Anyone can get up on a push bike and go out for the day on a push bike.
Yes.
Is this going to be changed, you know, because...
Vincent, obviously, the accident you describe, I don't know the exact circumstances of the cycling fatality that you describe.
Let me help you on that. It's a cyclist. She died after 3 days after the collision. It was Janina Galau. She was 26. She was on Ludgate Hill, close to the junction with Farringdon Street. She was taken to the Royal London Hospital with her family at her bedside. She'd come to London from Dusseldorf in Germany, was studying for a master's degree and completing her dissertation in London. The City of London police confirmed the lorry driver was not arrested. Police at the time investigated, and Vincent, the driver, has been cleared, Mr. Mayor.
Well, in any one of these deaths is one too many, and if you go out on the streets of London today, you will see police out in force on Operation Safeway trying to get cyclists to obey the law. I've just come through I've stopped at every red light, and it's quite incredible to see the number of police there. And actually, the cyclists I was with were very reassured by that, because it's good to see the police enforcing the law, not just for cyclists, but also for motorists who go into the advanced stop boxes and other motorists who break the law. Now, in the case of Vincent, who has obviously had a terrible experience, he's been at the wheel of a truck that has been involved in a fatal collision with a cyclist, and that's something he's going to have with him for the rest of his life. And it's of course, I understand the tragedy for Vincent as much as for the poor woman who died. And this is a totally awful thing to have happened. No, but can I, Vincent, if you'll allow me.
Back to you in a minute, Vincent.
What we need to do is to continue to educate cyclists about the importance of obeying the law of the road, and also to be aware of other road users. And one thing that we are particularly concerned about is obviously cyclists who do get caught up in heavy goods vehicles turning in one direction or the other, particularly turning left. And I'm afraid it's very often particularly female cyclists who seem to be the victims of these types of terrible accident. They're by no means... I just have it in my head that we've had a high...
Why do you suppose women have given the
proportion of male and female cyclists, I have it in my head that there's a higher proportion of... I think it may be because women are naturally more cautious or hang back more or some reason. I can't explain it.
So you shouldn't be cautious?
But what you need to do is to get in front of the vehicle, get in front of Vincent and his lorry, indicate, make sure that the truck driver knows you're there, indicate, wave, Vincent, if you'll allow me, be like Simon Rattle with the Berlin Philharmonic, or the Berlin, whatever it is, show the cyclist that you are there. And actually, to do that,
you've taken your hand off the handlebars.
No, you're stationary.
So you're executing
you're
a left-hand turn.
No, sorry. No, you're stationary. This is a traffic lights. And what?
Oh, I see.
Because typically, what will happen is that the traffic will be stationary, and this was what happened the other day, by the way, in Victoria, and yes, it was an absolutely ghastly accident, and the traffic was motionless, and then everybody took off, and a female cyclist just was caught by a lorry turning left. He simply didn't see her. The female cyclist was there, as it were, on the top left, underneath, as it were, in his blind spot on the left hand side of his cab, and he simply took off and didn't see her, and she sustained terrible injuries. Now, if you can indicate to the truck driver that you're there, you will greatly, greatly assist matters.
Let's talk to
the
driver.
I must insist that what I think Vincent wants us to do is to have, some system whereby we get cyclists off the road. We've got more and more cyclists on the road, and that is a good thing. And actually, what they are doing...
Yeah, because it's all for profit. It's Boris Bikes, just for profit. They're not for cyclists caring about cyclists.
No,
make it compulsory that they do a road traffic exam. Make it compulsory that they wear high-vis jackets that can be identified, so if they do commit road traffic, commit something that they shouldn't have done on the road, they can be clearly identified and punished for that.
We are punished
left, right and centre.
Most listeners will hear that you haven't been punished, because you plainly weren't at fault. And the tragedy of this is that a cyclist has lost her life. What we're trying to do is to educate both truck drivers and cyclists in safety on the roads. What we can't do is, I think, try to drive cyclists off the roads. What we must do is put in the infrastructure that we need to make cycling safer, and we're doing that with heavy investment in better cycleways. But I want to stress, Vincent, in spite of the tragic accident that you've experienced, the tragic accidents that I've described earlier on, if you look at the number of journeys that are now made by bike, and you look at the number of accidents, you can see that the accident rate, the killed, seriously injured rate is coming down and down. It is well down on what it was. Well, actually, it's coming down absolutely, not just in terms of the ratio. So that is an achievement by everybody who's trying to make cycling safer in London. And I'm grateful for the support and the help of the freight operators recognition scheme, people who work with freight operators to try to make our truck safer. We are bringing in, and I'm sure your truck already complied fully, Vincent, but we are bringing in London from September the world's first safer lorry scheme, which will mean that no truck can come into our city unless it has the kind of safety equipment that we would want to see on lorries.
And many of these fatalities have been caused because they don't have that bit of kit, is that right?
Well, it's certainly one of the biggest factors is that
the skirts
can be helpful, but the biggest factor, in my view, is that the cabs are so high up and it's very hard for the truck drivers to see around them. And unless they are properly fitted with proper mirrors, and indeed with CCTV, sometimes it is very difficult to spot cyclists. That's not yet part of the package. But ultimately, Nick, that kind of thing must be part of the package, unless we can substantially redesign the cabs.
Right.
If you get inside the cab of an HGV in London, they are incredibly high up.
Yes.
They can't see the rest of the road. It must be scary for a truck driver to be in that position of power and therefore of responsibility. We need to help them. Okay. We need to get them more visibility.
Safe driving to you, Vincent. We must move on, not diminishing the import of this, but there are other matters. There are other
Can we go to Ahmed in New Malden, please?
Good morning.
Good morning, sir.
Mr. Johnson, Mr. Ferrari.
Hello, sir.
How are you?
I'm fine, thank you for the opportunity. Yes, my question is that figures for the corruption cases for the Metropolitan Police have been published, have been revealed today. Now, one case is too many, especially when it concerns perverting the course of
justice. Ahmed, I don't think I don't have the benefit of this. Mr. Ferrari is shuffling through his papers here.
Let me just tell everyone, nearly 50 Metropolitan Police officers and 26 staff members have been suspended for alleged corruption in the past 2 years, figures just released. Of the 47 officers, 11 were convicted. This comes from a Freedom of Information request. A total of 222 officers were suspended between 2012 and 2014. On you go with your question, Ahmed.
Yes. Now, especially when it concerns perverting the course of justice, as was the case with Andrew Mitchell, the celebrated case with...
absolutely.
There are so many other minor cases. Now, how can you, the mayor, how can you please raise the standard awareness among the officers? I know Sir Bernard Hogan Howe is doing a grand job. He's very emphatic about cleaning up the clearing out the corrupt police officers. But how can you make sure the highest standards are always implemented?
Are always implemented, yes.
Well, Ahmed, it's an incredibly important question, and actually you're perfectly right in what you say about the recent figures. There has been a publication of the statistics over the last 2 years. I can't really give you a feel for whether that is getting better or worse, but 50 to be suspended over 2 years is obviously a lot. I think you have to set it in context. You're looking at an organisation of 52,000 people or thereabouts, 32,000 roughly frontline officers. You're talking about a huge number of people, but that is too many. Now, I suppose
says the threat to the Met of corrupt activity remains significant, Mr. Mayor. Her Majesty's Inspector General.
And they would be rash not to say that. At any stage, obviously, the police will come under terrific pressure. There will be terrific temptations from very wealthy criminal gangs and so on. I think it's extremely important that we stamp this out, and I know that Sir Bernard Hogan Howe wants to eradicate this kind of corruption as far as he possibly can. And if the only crumb of comfort I take from this, Ahmed, is that we really are being ruthless with people who are caught. Right. And people should know that if they serve in the police, then they are expected to conform to the utmost standards of probity. That was why the Andrew Mitchell business was so serious, not because Andrew Mitchell was an MP who might have been in some way stitched up, but because every member of the public, everybody in London, has got to have confidence in our police. And that's why we cracked down on it.
This is Nick Ferrari. More highlights of my week on breakfast after the news. This is LBC. See.